You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good afternoon, everybody. It is a real pleasure to welcome you here to the Carnegie Endowment. I'm David Rothkopf, and I'm a visiting scholar here at the Carnegie Endowment, and run a program here on America's role in the world, and one called the Bernard Schwartz Program on Competitiveness and Growth. And it is in that program that we are here hosting today's discussion featuring Deborah Spahr's book. This is Deborah Spahr, the president of Barnard College, who has written the book Wonder Women, which many of you have. Beside Deborah is Ambassador Susan Esserman, who was the Deputy United States Trade Representative and who leads the international trade practice at Steptoe & Johnson, a big firm here. And I felt since Deborah's book talks a lot about women's roles and also about women who have sort of managed to have it all or get close to it, I needed to find one of my friends who did. Sue fits the bill there. She has not only had this extraordinary career, but raised three sons, not one, but two of whom have been the managing editor of the Harvard Crimson. Top that. And frankly, makes me feel kind of underachiever all the time. But in any event, I want to frame the discussion very briefly, and then we'll let Deborah talk for a few minutes, and then we will have just a conversation among us and then draw you into it. But, you know, I in addition to running this program, am the CEO and editor of Foreign Policy Magazine, and I have noticed in the course of doing the work that I do at Foreign Policy Magazine and doing the work that I've done here in Washington and the Clinton administration, that when you talk about women's issues, they tend to get sort of kicked off into a kind of an intellectual ghetto or a policy ghetto. Hillary Clinton did a lot of great things, and I wrote some articles about what she did as Secretary of State, and people go, yeah, but what did she do? You know, she just dealt with women's issues. And I'm like, well, this is the majority population of the planet, and the systematic suppression of women throughout the course of all history, which has led to millions and millions of deaths and a lot of other kinds of scarring, has got to be the most grievous set of wrongs that have been done in all of human history. And these issues are central to economic considerations. They're central to security considerations. They're clearly central to political considerations and how societies work. And yet, these are soft policy. These aren't subjects for serious people to discuss. And that, in and of itself, encapsulates the problem. So when Deborah, who I have known for a while, came out with this book, I thought this was a terrific opportunity to bring this discussion out and take a look at it at two levels. On the one level, Deborah has a great message for women who are trying to tackle the challenges of succeeding within this society. But on another level, she cuts to some of the core questions that are critical competitiveness and growth and equity and security and development issues, which just simply have to do with how we treat women, and in particular, why the progress which I, by the way, sort of thought was going to happen a lot faster back when I was in college and there seemed to be a revolution going on, why it's stalled, why it's not happening, why it's not happening as fast as it should be happening. So we'll try to talk about both of those things. But of course, the appropriate way to do this kind of thing here is to hear a little bit from Deborah about her book and why she wrote the book, and then we'll open it up to some conversation. So, Deborah, why don't you frame it? Deborah's been running like crazy. I mean, those of you who've seen her, you know, on television and in the newspaper, and I talked to her the other day, and she said, oh, I just did 10 radio shows in the past hour.
That one was hard.
She's having it all except eating and sleeping at the moment. So that if you can...
If I start,
you know,
slurring my
start
words...
Start slurring your words, Will, that Sue and I will cover for
thank
you.
Thank you. Right. Well, thank you. It's great to see so many of you here taking time out of what I'm sure are busy days. And I want to just start with a huge thank you to David not only for organizing this event, but for really supporting me and supporting this book. And to jump ahead to one of the conclusions of the book, one of the major things I'm arguing is that we're never going to solve the so-called women's problem unless we invite men into the conversation and unless men really take an interest in solving what is way too often seen as a ghettoized problem. I couldn't agree more with
that
word.
And for the 8 men who are here with us today, thank you very much.
I think we've got more than 8. Wait, put your hands up if you're a man. All right, thank you. I spoke. It's definitely more than 8. I spoke at Politics and Prose last night, and about, I'd say, a third of the audience was male. And I spoke at one of the big investment banks last week, and at least a third of the audience was male. Some of them may have had their arms twisted, but I tend to think not. And I really do think that, and I'm jumping way ahead to my conclusions. But I think we've come to a moment in time where most men are no longer sitting in the corner office evilly plotting how to keep women from climbing up to the executive suite. Most men that I've encountered in various parts of, you know, the quarters of power, they have wives or who are working and who are juggling. They, like you, have daughters who they fundamentally want to succeed. They have female colleagues whose careers they've mentored or sponsored. So I really think the time has come to bring men into the conversation and really acknowledge that the so-called women's problem is not a women's problem. It's a societal problem. And just seconding for a moment what David just said, if you just look at the basic math, the fact that 50% or whatever it is, 51% of the world's population is stalling out at a level far below what we might have predicted 50 years ago is a global problem. It's a huge problem in this country because women are now 50% of college students. They're 50% of most graduate school programs. They're still fall farther behind in business school, but they're not advancing to the top tiers of power. So we're losing that investment. If you just think about it in terms of return on investment, we as a society are not gaining from the investment we're making in women's lives and careers. And then if you look to other parts of the world where women's rights are trampled in a much more fundamental way, we're dealing with, as you said, and as Secretary Clinton embraced, security issues, global issues, rights issues. And I'm not going to talk about those things today, but let me just put it out there to say solving women's issues should be a global priority. Secretary Clinton made it one. I hope it's sustained. We shall see. But let me just take a couple of minutes to talk about the origins and the basic themes of this book. One of the basic sort of starting points of the book is that I didn't grow up considering myself a feminist. You know, far from it. And the original title of the book, which no publisher would let me use, was Confessions of a Reluctant Feminist. And it's sort of interesting. No publisher would let me use it because they said, if you write a book with feminist in the title, no one will buy it. Which is telling in and of itself. So they put sex in the title instead, and it seems to be selling. Full stop. But I grew up at a moment in time that I think is quite interesting. I grew up right after the feminist revolution. Everyone in the world now knows how old I am. I was born in 1963, which means that by the time I came of age, politically and socially, most of the major revolutions had already occurred. By the time it was of concern to me, Roe v. Wade was law. Contraception was widely available. The bras had ostensibly been burned, although, of course, it turns out no bras actually were burned, but we sort of thought they had been burned. All of the Ivy League, with the exception of Columbia, was open to women. Graduate schools were kind of falling over themselves to admit well-qualified women. So from my perhaps slanted perspective, being female in, you know, 1976, 78 was actually a great advantage because there were benefits to be had by being a smart, ambitious young girl. And I was more than happy to just grab those advantages and run with them. And I really didn't see any need to read feminist theory or to study feminism. And I think at some fundamental level, I understood that it was a ghettoized field. So I went to Georgetown and then went on to get my PhD in political science, but I never studied feminist theory. I studied Soviet military thought until that country had the bad taste to disintegrate right as I was publishing my dissertation. forced me on a different career path. But I really stayed consciously away from women's issues. And what had influenced me heavily, and it's somewhat embarrassing to admit, but was sort of all of the cultural themes that had surrounded me growing up. The sort of central one, which I profile in the book, was the commercial for Charlie perfume, which I think most of you of a certain age will remember. Not a particularly good perfume, but a fabulous commercial. Because what it showed, it really captured the very idealized and trivialized version of the modern woman. It was a model, it was Shelley Hack was the central figure, in a fabulous pantsuit. This was when pantsuits were very cool. And she was walking clearly to work because she had a pantsuit on, and there was a briefcase somewhere. And in some of the ads, there's a child who's sort of there but not causing any trouble. And then there's, you know, men literally show up and douse her with perfume. And, you know, who wouldn't like this life? And I think, you know, girls of a certain age, perhaps a little bit superficially, really did grow up believing that this was what feminism had brought us. We could have careers and be financially independent and still be very attractive and probably have children that didn't cause any trouble tucked away. And who wouldn't like that image? So I grew up with that image and to some extent, you know, think I had realized it until reality started to set in. And it set in slowly over you know, a period of years and even decades. First, when I just started to realize that most of my friends from college who had been equally smart and as ambitious had not remained in the workforce. They had gotten married and had kids and had stepped out of the workplace. It came in even starker relief when I was at Harvard Business School and after a number of years realized that literally none of the women who had started with me as junior professors received tenure. Wow. And if any of you read the article in the New York Times on Harvard Business School, that's still kind of what the statistics look like for female faculty. They're abysmal. And probably most scarily, I started to realize that my students at Harvard Business School were having very divergent experiences based on their gender. So the men were going off and running the world, and the women were not. And as I sort of rose through the ranks, I was increasingly asked by various deans to sort of solve the women's problem. You know, let's get Deb to solve the women's problem. And that caused me to realize two key facts. The first was that there was a women's problem at Harvard Business School and in society generally. That I had sort of chosen to ignore that, but there very much was a women's problem. And secondly, that it was a really tough one to solve. And I think well-intentioned people were sort of asking women to solve the problem. But the problem that women face today, we were just talking about this before, is I think a much more subtle problem than the problem that women faced 50 years ago, 60 years ago. You know, the brilliance of feminism was that it changed, turned societal norms upside down, got rid of many of the most obvious constraints on women's lives and choices, gave women reproductive rights, reproductive control, opened up the Ivy League and the Supreme Court and every channel of opportunity. But what didn't change as a result of feminism was the expectations that women still carried with them. So where I argue we are today is that women now have all of the expectations that feminism has created to be Supreme Court judges, to be nuclear scientists, to run Fortune 500 corporations, to be athletic, to save the world, to start an NGO before they're 18, so far as I can tell from all of my applicants at Barnard. But we never got rid of the older expectations, so women are still expecting and aspiring to be good wives and mothers, to take care of their children, to take care of their partners, to take care of their homes. And so rather than actually freeing women from expectations, I argue and I fear that we've wound up in a place that women are just facing a multitude of expectations, which is captured by this horrible phrase, having it all, which if you think about it for a moment, is just a lie and an illusion. Nobody has it all. No woman, no man, no human being. By definition, no one person can have it all. And yet we've stumbled into a place where the bar is set so high for women that by definition we're going to fail. If what you're supposed to do is have it all, then you're failing if you have anything short of all. And so what I'm really trying to do in the book is partly just lay out the historical context of feminism and where I think women are today, because I think that the context is quite important. Then I try to trace through the actual chapters of a woman's life. And this is where the book gets personal, because I use stories from my own life to sort of anchor each of the chapters. I talk about how we raise girls and the kinds of expectations that we're still thrusting with all best intentions on very young girls. I talk about body image and how, sadly, rather than moving to a place where women's looks and body image have become less important over time, I think they've actually become more important. You know, just look at any single magazine out there on the rack. There's a chapter, horrifyingly, on sex. I think I may be the first college president who's written a book that has sex in the title.
That might be a good thing, though.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Stay tuned on that one. But what I look at in that chapter is I look at what's happened as we have changed the sexual norms that surround women. And part of this story is very, very positive insofar as women have a much greater degree of freedom in their sexual lives. But I also fear, and this is the point at which I sound hopelessly middle-aged, that the norms that are surrounding young women today, the hookup culture norms, are in fact quite damaging. Because they actually, ironically, I think, create a greater set of expectations on how women should be running their sex lives, an expectation that I think actually runs counter to what many of them would choose to do. There's a chapter on marriage, and how marriage has and has not changed. And again, I would argue we've sort of upped the ante on marriage, which is sort of ironic given what's happening in the sexual realm. So sort of the expectation is now that women are supposed to be carefreely promiscuous for some period of years and then fall hopelessly and forever in love with someone they find when they're 35, just in time to have children. So it's, you know, it's kind of harder than the old expectations, if you think about it. And we've totally fetishized the white wedding, which makes no sense anymore. And even we're now seeing same-sex couples fetishizing a white wedding that really makes no sense. So I leave that for you to muddle through. And then there's a chapter on distribution of labor within the household, chapter on the workplace, and a chapter on aging. So I'm really trying to argue that the issues women face are not just workplace issues, although that's a big part of it. The issues women face are really issues of expectations, that they're trying to deal with the workplace, which remains a complicated arena, while they're trying to deal with how they look and how they raise their children and how they handle their marriages and how they make sure the dishes are all out of the sink before they get to work in the morning. I conclude on what I think is actually remarkably, perhaps quite an optimistic note, because I think that the problems that I've outlined are in fact quite solvable. And I don't know what any of you do, but just guessing, you know, being in this city, many of you deal with problems that truly are intractable. You know, the Middle East is tough. You know, I don't know how you even in theory begin to think about that. But the problems I lay out, at least theoretically, they're pretty easy to resolve. And part of it, by way of conclusion, is to bring men into the conversation, to point to some of the nitty-gritty obstacles that really still stand in women's way, both at home and in the workplace. Part of it, I think, is crucially resetting the dialogue so we're not talking about having it all, which is insane. We're talking about choice, which interestingly was, of course, one of the core words of the original feminism. You know, having choices is great, but you actually have to make them. And that means taking decisions and saying yes to some things and no to others. And that doesn't mean yes to career and no to children or vice versa. But if you want yes to career and yes to family, you kind of have to say no to lots of other things. So how do we reframe that conversation? And finally, and this is a bit still sort of verboten, but I do argue in the book and I do believe that we need to acknowledge that biology matters, which is something that, you know, arguably early feminism kind of ignored, perhaps for good reasons. But I am stating, which is, you know, it's just a fact, women are physiologically different than men. Those facts become particularly important when you talk about children. And that the workforce needs to get over some of it, the kind of yuck factor in dealing with just the physicality of being a mother. And acknowledging that men and women, and this is what got Larry Summers in a lot of trouble, but I can sort of say this and he can't. women and men may lead differently. They may have different, in the aggregate, embedded preferences and styles. And so if we want to make a workforce that really is equal, we may have to acknowledge the differences that women manifest. So it's a book that that covers a lot of ground. Will probably get me into a fair amount of trouble. But I'm hoping that I'm adding to what has really suddenly become an exploding conversation, and I think appropriately so, about how we hit the next level in thinking about women's issues. Part of it is still structural and governmental changes, but I think equally important are the sort of the cultural and the societal and the normative changes that are subtle and are harder to attack, but I think are equally important in framing and shaping women's lives. So let me stop there.
No, that's great. And here's what we're going to do. I'm going to ask them a couple of questions. We're going to talk amongst ourselves, but you can listen for about 20 or 30 minutes. And then I'd love to have you guys come in with questions. So as we're going, think about the questions so that when we get to the end of the 20 or 25 minutes of conversation, you're ready to jump in. So what I'd like to do is, if I may, is ask you to put this in a bit of a Washington context. We've known each other 20 years. We got to know each other in the Clinton administration. We came into that Clinton administration with certain kinds of expectations. And you came at it from, you know, also kind of a remarkable family. You have two sisters who are off. One's a radiologist, one's a surgeon. You sort of come in and you went to Wellesley, you went to a women's college. I think you sort of had certain set of expectations. And then you found the reality of Washington. And I just think from the point of view of this audience, framing it a little bit in the reality of Washington for women would be a great counterpoint that we can open it up.
Well, I actually think that the reality of Washington, if you're looking at the kinds of issues that Deborah is talking about, is very similar. What you have talked about, your book strikes a huge chord. I was telling Deborah I had a little session on Sunday with a number of the women in my firm in which we were discussing the book. And, you know, it was incredibly well received because what I think young women want is to get the issues out on the table. And so I actually think the Washington context is like other contexts in the United States, is perfect. What you say fits very much within the challenges that people face. I think as you yourself acknowledge in the book, we're talking about people with resources, because the people without resources face a whole nother set of problems. The single mom with two jobs and family, I frankly don't even understand how they can cope, and it gets to one of the bigger issues that you're talking about in terms of government support. But in Washington, many men and women are in high-powered jobs, whether it's government or private sector. And, you know, what I did, I actually come with a different perspective, although I very much embrace your conclusions. I embrace the women's movement. I'm 10 years older than you are, and I could see palpably how the women's movement was opening up for opportunities that hadn't existed 10 years ago for me. And I think one thing that's very important is the women's movement is evolving. It's been evolving. And I think what we need to do is put people like you and Sheryl Sandberg together with these great women's groups that are out there to support, to work for societal change. Because I think that what women, in many women in Washington are pressed with incredible schedules, deadlines, and what we need to do is have a better societal support for having a career and a family. It's a strange thing. We have to. We all know that for society to perpetuate itself, women are going to have babies, yet we don't plan for that in any organized way. That is such a crazy thing, and that's why I love what you were saying about Sweden, where Sweden builds in this longer, like 18 months maternity leave, and some of it must be taken by the father. We have not done what we need to do in the institutions to change and to support family life. And so I think that women in Washington working face a lot of these very same pressures, but we don't, I think there isn't the kind of support. And that's one of the reasons why I've been very active on these issues, to really help young women coming up to find a way to balance these things. Because as Deborah was saying, today the barriers are not, generally not overt. They're intangible. And there, it's implicit bias. And that's why you see, as you document in the book, in law and in medicine and in corporations, a small percentage of the women who started making it up to the top. And, you know, it's a struggle to try to figure out how to really make the change. That's why I think the change has to be institutional. It has to be by the women, their partners, and societally. I think we need major change if we're really going to try to address these issues.
But also, you were in the Clinton administration, a Democratic administration full of people who were self-described liberals. There were a bunch of women in senior roles in this administration, and there were boys' clubs all over the place, right? I mean, let's
just
put it up.
We were just talking about that.
Right.
Well, that's something that really did affect me. I so appreciated that President Clinton and Hillary Clinton had a real commitment to bringing women in the high levels of government. But again, what you saw is this implicit, not bias, it's just the clubbiness in which it is so easy for women to be on the other side of the room with 10 guys. And, you know, there's an inadvertent exclusion. There's so many ways in which this comes into play, notwithstanding fantastic expectations. And you see that across other institutions, too. You know, I actually was I left private practice of law for 9 years. And when I came back, I was really shocked to see that there had been very little progress in terms of women moving up to the higher echelons in law. I'm speaking generally. And if you look at today compared to 15 years ago, I think there's been
no movement. One of the things I talk about in the book is what I call the 16% ghetto. But if you look across all sectors of society, law is particularly bad, but not that bad. Women have maxed out at the highest levels between 15 and 20% of the seats. I think so. Women are 50% of law school students, but they're 15% of partners.
And if you look at, and I would just say one thing just to frame this, if you look at associates in law firms, 45%. And yet, these are average numbers. Across the United States, women represent, I think, approximately 17% of partners. Now, the good news is that in 1979, there was one woman general counsel in all of the Fortune 500 companies. Today, there are 108.
Well, there's been a lot of...
I do think that's going to make a difference. I hope that women will be looking out. Women will look out for women.
It does make a difference. And, you know, Jessica Matthews, who runs this place, was one of the first women to serve in the National Security Council. Her mother was the first woman to get into the Council on Foreign Relations.
Wow.
You know, that's, you know, sort of in the 70s. You know, that we've come a long way. But we have plateaued. And, you know, I've seen articles in the past couple of weeks celebrating how many women are in Congress, except... it's around under 20%. The average in legislatures around the world is 17%. Rwanda is an exception, 54% Rwanda.
But mandated.
But 17%. In corporate boardrooms, it's
16%.
16%. I did a book called Superclass on the most sort of successful people in the world, you know, richest, most powerful people in the world. And the single group that's most left out was women, because it was only 6% women. It was 94% men. We do at Foreign Policy an annual ranking of the most powerful women. It's the same thing. It's about 6% women and 94% men. And yet, where's the urgency? What happened? You know, how did this thing stall? Is it inertia? Is it too much pushback? What's the reason?
I think, you know, it's very easy to blame the pipeline. To say, well, of course we're not going to get law partners because there's not enough women coming in as associates. But history doesn't allow us to make that argument anymore, because the pipeline has been full
for
at least 1.5 generations. So you can't make that argument. What's happening, if the best you can sort of parse the statistics out, is women rise to the VP level in a corporation, associate in a law firm, associate professor, and then they start to trickle off. They particularly trickle off when they have children. And there seems a couple of studies have pointed to it's the birth of the second child that really forces the woman to make tough decisions, or the juggling just seems to get too hard. And I think that's compounded by the sort of clubbiness that you were just referencing. So I really don't think it's the corporations or the law firms sort of slaying women once they reach a certain level, but it's the combination of women encountering environments that, while not yet hostile, are still male-dominated, with the fact that the juggling just gets increasingly tough. The one other thing I'll just put out there, which is unscientific, I think insofar as we've developed maternity policies and family leave policies, all of which is good, they're still way too narrow in focus. So we argue over whether it should be 6 weeks or 6 months, but so what? What happens after 6 months? You have a six-month-old. You know, life has not gotten easy. You know, sorry, it just hasn't. And, you know, or a two-year-old, whatever it is. You know, raising a child is a 20-year endeavor.
Longer.
And then they come home again, right? So,
especially now,
they come home. But, you know, and then if you compound that with elderly parents who, you know, demographically occur around the same time, we've built in infant leave policies. We actually haven't even thought about family policies.
And see, that's what I think we need to build into our society, because it isn't just a 3 month or 6 month thing. It's over time. And I was very taken by your analysis, this business of the double whammy with these expectations that women continue to have, even though the whole idea of the women's movement was that you were to shed those fixed expectations. So that's something that deeply troubles me, that women still, or I think there is a sense that women think it's expected that they need to do everything. I will say, I did not do everything. And I, of course, nobody has it all. Life's about trade-offs. You have to make choices, as you say in your book, about what is important to you. But I think we also need to build support for men taking a greater role. And we should insist and incentivize it, because that is something you note in your book that has come along, not as progressed as much. And that's something that's really surprised me. I think in the younger generation just coming into the workforce, you see more evidence of that. But we need to do whatever we can to incentivize that, because the thing that makes me sad when I've read a little bit of Anne-Marie Slaughter's piece and she's saying, well, we could say, I read the argument that we can give men 50% of the role, but frankly, women won't want to do that. Well, I say, let's encourage it. When men want to do it, let's encourage them taking a greater role, because I think this intense mothering that in some ways perhaps excludes men is not good parenting.
And the societies that have done more, strangely enough, Northern European societies, Scandinavian societies, actually outperform the world in economic performance, in fiscal responsibility, in quality of life, in quality of healthcare, in quality of education. There is a direct correlation between mandated equity and higher performance, which gets to another question, which you allude to, and it's, you know, we can call it the Larry Summers question, because that always makes everything sound so much more interesting. but which is about the quality of leadership, about the nature that, you know, what happens with a balance. Aside from your book, one of the things that you wrote that I like best, and by the way, Deborah's written a bunch of other books on completely different subjects, which are great, but you wrote an article in the midst of the Wall Street hubbub, saying if more women were in charge in Wall Street, this wouldn't have happened this way. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, and I think I said it might not have happened that way, so I won't be. But I did raise in that article, and a bunch of other people have written about this subsequently. You know, we know a fact, most of the people running Wall Street before the crisis were men, still are. But men have, and a number of studies have increasingly demonstrated this, have a higher propensity for risk-taking, particularly financial risk-taking, than women, for better or worse. That's just sort of what the statistics show. There's also a beautiful study out of Cambridge that shows, even given a set group of men, traders are more inclined to take higher risks when they have higher levels of testosterone in their bodies. So there may be literally a hormonal connection to risk-taking, which would suggest that in something like a bank, you might want to have diversity of the decision makers so that you have the risk taking, because that's how our financial system operates, but you also have the risk prevention, the risk moderation. And I don't know if it would have changed things, but I think it's an interesting proposition to put out there. And, you know, I've lived this sort of odd life over the past few years that I spent so many years at Harvard Business School, which was, you know, a heavily testosterone-induced organization. And then I moved to Barnard College, where you kind of can't find testosterone with a search party. So it's been a fascinating move for me. And I say that without casting aspersion on either side of the hormonal divide. But I think it should be said, or at least I felt it, that a male-dominated workplace feels fundamentally different from a female-dominated workplace. The jokes are different.
Oh, yeah.
No, they are. I always joke that, you know, when in order to get promoted at Harvard Business School, I had to learn an awful lot of Australian rugby trivia. And I actually did, because, you know, in order to make chatter and just, you know, talk at parties, I had to know a lot more about...
Sue is a
expert.
Washington Capitals hockey fan.
Okay, all right, so that's good.
I can do it.
But I wasn't. But, you know, the jokes are different. The nature of power is different. You know, I've found in more male-dominated places, people are more comfortable with hierarchical power structures. There's a general sense of, you know, here's how the authority flows, and here's what I will abide by. Whereas in more female-dominated places, people are less comfortable with conflict and less comfortable with overt demonstrations of power, much more consensual, for both better and worse. Women leaders, I think, have a greater propensity to want to be liked, which makes their management style different. So I think starting to play these out without being polemical about it ideally should lead us to a more balanced and better workplace.
It's another question where there's a Washington corollary. You know, there's some jobs that are more men's jobs, and there's some jobs that are more women's jobs. There's some pursuits, you know. Julia Swag here from Council on Foreign Relations. Latin America, there's women. You know, you can go into Latin America if you're a woman, you know. But if, you know, there's certain, right? You know, and then there's some areas where not so much. And we still haven't had a woman Secretary of Defense, although many countries in Latin America have had women running their defense ministries. We in the intelligence community, in the military, in some of these places, they are still heavily boys' clubs.
Yeah.
And that changes the way that countries work too, right? I mean, it's got to have an effect.
Well, now you've just teed it up for me. I think that one thing that really could make a difference in terms of people's expectations is having a woman president. And as David knows,
this will happen soon.
Yes. Because actually, I think that sends a lot of signals to the world and to our own women. And I await the day. And that was one of the reasons why, you know, when you'll see dealing, often, sometimes when I'm dealing in my work with generals, people from military background, you can see the, not intended, but the kind of, the condescension that is there. And I when that happens, I keep thinking, someday, there's going to be a woman president. I think it is really important. I think that it will really change things. I wanted to go back to what you were saying, Deborah, because I read with trepidation that one section when you were saying that you'll say what Larry Summers could not say, and you recognize some of the sensitivity to it. Because I do, you know, fear how we develop that, because I would never want it to be suggested that women aren't equal in their ability.
Right.
It's how you're saying how they operate in the workforce. So I love this example that you gave. And I think you talk a little bit about in the book, which is that we ought to broaden out the qualities that we're looking for in leadership and bring in the great qualities that many women bring and value them. And that is one way to bring it in. And, you know, I hope we can do it that way rather than to have these different tracks, because I fear that could go
right.
Awfully wrong.
Well, and also look, I mean, we've got some great examples of that working, right? The European financial crisis of the past year was essentially solved in a partnership between Christine Lagarde and Angela Merkel.
Yeah.
You know, and Angela Merkel was just reelected to a third term. She is not super charismatic. She's not, kind of spellbinding speaker like our current president. But unlike the presidents of all the countries that she's dealt with, she's got higher popularity ratings. She's she managed to produce results. She didn't produce threat in all the people around her in a certain way. She managed her way around the Bundesbank. And there are lots of examples. Michelle Bachelet, who caused a lot of pushback in Chile when she said, I'm going to have a cabinet that's half men and half women. And Chileans actually said, oh, how's she going to find 10 women for the cabinet? Was so successful that she's likely to be the next president of Chile again. And, you know, you've got Dilma Rousseff changing the world in certain ways, winning a lot of friends here in Washington at the moment, but you reap what you sow, you know. But anyway, the point is, there are a lot of examples out there of different approaches to leadership where they're great success stories. And we could go on and on. I mean, there's a lot of them. So, I kind of wonder why it's taken so long for the message to sink home here.
Well, can I just say one thing you touched on in the book? It's something that is really a painful memory for me, and that is that I think there's still a lot of misogyny in our society. And just watching the 2008 election, the primary campaign, some of the things that were said, regardless of who you were for, some of the things that were said about Hillary Clinton were just shocking. In the media, all the time, and no one was accountable for it. And I think these are the sorts of things that actually hold women back to today. You talk about it a little bit. You were talking about when President Obama came to speak at Barnard and some of the misogynist comments that came out. How do we address that?
Yeah, it's a great point, and it's a really tough one. I mean, just to throw one other example out, probably all aware of this, but you probably weren't reading it that closely. In New York, we just had Christine Quinn running for mayor. She was, everyone presumed, the front runner, and yet she just totally, you know, sputtered over the course of the campaign and wound up, you know, with a very small percent of the vote. And constantly there were comments in the media about her pantsuits, about her hair, about, you know, the way she dressed. And as I think it was Jody Cantor pointed out, you know, nobody ever asked why Bill de Blasio, who wound up getting the Democratic nomination, didn't buy a more expensive suit. And yet, it's amazing that we're at a point that mainstream media, this isn't, you know, I won't mention any names, it's not far-right conservative media. I'm with friends, right? You know, mainstream media finds nothing wrong with commenting on women's look and their clothing. When I give up sort of a PowerPoint presentation of this talk, I have this quote. It was on the front page of the New York Times, my beloved New York Times, when Christine Lagarde comes into the IMF on the heels of a guy who's just been accused of rape, and they're commenting on her shoes and her handbags. This is not relevant. And yet, you're entirely right. There is no calling out of what, you know, it's not damaging to say that, you know, Christine Lagarde wears Chanel suits, but it is. It's embedded misogyny. And it always makes clear that women are being evaluated on things other than their professional qualifications. The one other sort of broader example I'll just throw out there because it makes me kind of nuts. Every time there's a woman in business and there's a story about her, it talks about her family life and her kids. You know, poor Marissa Meyer. You know, she's trying to turn a company around with a one-year-old, and people are constantly commenting on both her parenting style and her commitment to social change. Nobody writes articles about Bill Gates that way.
No.
You know, when people write stories comparing Lloyd Blankfein and Jamie Dimon, no one even knows whether they have children. It's just not an issue. And yet every portrayal of a woman in a position of power thinks it's fair game to talk about her clothing and her home life. I don't know how we change that, but we have to stop at least amongst ourselves talking about it.
That is something that's really important. Women need to be supportive of other women's choices. What really bugged me about the debate between Anne-Marie Slaughter and Sheryl Sandberg is these forces that supported either position. They were in the high attack mode. They were women. Yeah. And, you know, my perspective was, wow, each of them are saying interesting things.
Right. Well, I got to say, you may not want me to say this, but, you know, Deborah's book's got a lot of great response, great reviews. It deserves it. It's a great book. I read it in one sitting. It's really a great book. The Times review was, you know, a little mixed on the basis of the most idiotic premise that you could possibly imagine. Here you have a subject, the future of half of humanity.
Yes.
And it's like, sorry, the it's too late. It's peaked.
Carol wrote the book already.
You know, there's one book that's been written about that, and so we don't need anything else about it. You know?
By a woman.
And this is the classic example of this, you know, idiocy. Because I think one of the great virtues of your book is you're not saying, and in fact, you have known Anne-Marie for a long, long time, right? And you, Sheryl Sandberg said, lean in a speech at Barnard, right? You know, you're sort of in the middle, but you're saying you don't have to choose. There's no one right answer, right? It's different for everybody, and you sort of have to find a way to coalesce those things to produce forward movement across society, unless I've got it wrong.
No, that's exactly right. And just to sort of expand on it briefly, you know, I think this is so important that there is no one path to, you know, how to lead a good life as a woman. I mean, how could there be? There's billions of us. And yet women do tend to be so critical of other women's choices. And we've just got to stop. Anyone who's been on a playground recently, oh, do you work? Really? I work. Do you work? You know, I mean, we have to stop that. You know, we just totally have to stop that. Because, men, I think, do less of that. There's less of this sort of, you know, you made certain choices, I made
going
different choices.
Going to the
choices.
Playground?
That too,
yeah,
probably, yeah.
Well, anyway, by the way, one of the cures for this in the financial services sector is the fact that Deborah's on the board of Goldman Sachs. So, you know, there is a bit of a movement of change that's going on here. Julia, kick it off.
First of all, I just want to thank all three of you for such a wonderful conversation. And Deborah, I'm halfway through your book, and it will, I hope, be a bestseller because it's a book of
24 as of yesterday.
Not the
24?
24.
Yes.
Not that she's...
I'm watching.
Not that she's counting, right?
I'm about halfway through it, and it's one of those books, at least for my demographic, our demographic, that it says what we've all been thinking in this spectacular, well-documented, compelling way. So thank you and congratulations. 14 years ago, when I started to work at the Council on Foreign Relations and my second child was born, I took a total of 3 weeks off and went back to work after 3 weeks. And when I was off for those 3 weeks, I got a call from one of my bosses, whose name shall not be mentioned, saying, you know, while you're at home on this maternity leave, you should really be working on your book. That child is now 14, and I pick him up Wednesdays early now and go home before his late soccer practice, and I work and he works. And from the other room this past Wednesday, I hear, Mom, what does gynocentric mean? So, you know, we're moving forward, but and I answered him. But here's my question. On the issue of how to talk to men and involve men in this conversation, I've really struggled with that. I'm sure we all have. It's a very charged and difficult and complex challenge, and David, you're exceptional. You're exceptional for a number
That's
of reasons.
That's how to talk to men on this channel.
That's how to talk to men on anything.
but you know, I would like, if you would allow it, moderator, all three of you, to address that issue, how one does that in the workplace, how one begins to really bring men into this conversation. I think it's very difficult. So I don't want to let you off the hook.
All right, I'll start, because I've probably thought about this specifically. I think, and first of all, a lot of this will depend on your personal style, because people have to do it in a way that feels natural for them. But I think particularly as women do ascend up the ladder, they have an obligation to pull men aside from time to time, when appropriate, and say, I'm sure you didn't mean to do this, but this is what just happened. And I did, just to give, I do this all the time now, and I try to be sweet about it, because I don't want to, you know, be hostile. But I was on a panel, and there were four men and me, or three men and me, and it was a sort of a fancy event, and the moderator asked each of the three men two questions about global business and China and the Middle East, and then asked me the diversity question.
Oh.
And this happens all the time. And so, and I could watch steam coming out of the ears of the women in the audience. And so I went to his boss and to him and to every other person, man on the panel, and I said, I know none of you men for this happen, but do you just, and they were all gobsmacked, had no idea that this was deemed offensive. But those are the little things that happen constantly, and I think we just have to call them out. And I, that guy will never make that mistake again. The other thing that I think younger women, I hope.
So you were really nice about it.
I was nice. And this is one of these guys who has a couple of daughters and is firmly committed to women's rights, but he just didn't see it. The other thing, and this one is harder. You know, I think for younger women, particularly when, and younger men, if they should be part of this too, when they are, you know, starting families, they kind of have to have the courage to go to their bosses and say, this is what I'm going to need. You know, this is what will help me to balance, because I think it will be different. You know, for some people, it's a 6-week maternity leave or 6-month maternity leave. For some people, it's, you know, I want 3 months, but I want to make sure that I can get a day a week for the next year. Or, you know, and I think we women have to be a little bit bolder in asking for these things, asking specifically for what they want, because their bosses may not know it. And then in order to have those conversations, and this is what I say to my students, they have to be really good at their jobs. You know, they have to phrase this in the context of, you don't want me to leave. I want to stay. You don't want me to leave. This is how we can negotiate it to make it doable. That's more idealistic than the first part.
Well, this is a complicated question, and I 100% agree with Deborah. You do really, there are really times when you have to call people out on it. And I do that. Quite a bit. I try to do it in a nice way and not in public, because I think that's going to yield better performance in the future. But I think that it really is very specific. But that's something I've worked a lot on in my firm, changing policies. And what I try to do is really gain some allies, get people. I try to understand who I'm approaching and what would be the best way to incentivize them to see the importance of some of these things. Actually, one of the things that we've done in law firms, because, you know, we're sort of at the point where sometimes actually people get very threatened if the women are going to meet by themselves. Like, what's happening in there? You know, what are you doing? Why do you need to meet? And I would always say, trust me, you want us to meet, because we're going to be more fulfilled, more effective, and bringing more revenues and supporting the bottom line. But it took me a very long time to get something started in the firm, because people didn't understand why we were doing it. And what we were doing is we were helping to provide mentorship, help to provide tips for success to the women, so we could try to deal with this issue of progression. But in the end, that would never be enough. You would need to get men to support it, so you try to figure out what matters to them. So to some men, it really does matter that a number of our clients are saying, there is a diversity requirement condition for hiring. We need to see what are your diversity statistics, and we need to see how you assemble your teams, not just for the show, who's actually working on it. So for some people, that would be what I would approach it, because that's the way they think. For others, you appeal to other things, knowing your audience. But it's key. I would love to talk to you about it sometime. It's a complicated issue and very personal to the particular institution. But I try to approach everybody individually and with a group and circle them.
Well, you asked me, and then we'll get to the questions. I'll say two things. One, I learned this lesson about having the women meet in the hardest possible way very early on, because my two little daughters one day were sitting in the kitchen talking to their mother, and I walked into the room and they stopped talking. And I said, what's going on here? And my five-year-old daughter, that will forgive everything I'm about to say, turned to me and said, you wouldn't understand because you have that thing down there where your vagina is supposed to be. And I was like, okay. And I sort of stepped out of the room. You know, I've run a couple of companies, and in my life, and you encounter this in different ways in different companies. I'll tell you a couple of things that I picked up. One, not all women are good to women. There's the Madeleine Albright comment about there's a special place in hell for the people who are not. I've encountered lots of women when I was writing this book and in my life who are, you know, found their own way and just been brutal to the women around them. And, you know, these are people who should be culled from the herd. And I've done my best because it's not good for the company. Women, you know, obviously are a huge resource to any organization, and people who behave that way are essentially shutting the door on a huge resource. So that's part of the problem. I'm not naming names in that regard, but I work in another company. Claire Casey is here, and she runs the day-to-day operations of the other company that I work in. And I'll tell you another problem that we've had. First of all, Claire's been there from the beginning. It's been a spectacular manager of the company. We have spectacular women in the company. One of the things that happens, particularly in small and mid-sized companies, is you discover you can hire women for less. You know, and you can get people from the best schools with great degrees and great experience. They'll work for less. And there's a real temptation to do that. And you have to fight the temptation. You know, you have to go and say these people have to be paid at their market rate. And women can't beat around the bush. And I don't think Mika Brzezinski is one of the great philosophers of our time, but she did have a book out not too long ago which makes this point very clearly. If women in the workplace have got to make the demands clear, they can't be nice about it, they can't go into another room and talk about it, it doesn't happen enough. So directness is absolutely a critical element of this as well. Let's go to the back and then we'll work forward.
Thank you. Actually, kind of a nice segue.
Why don't you guys identify yourselves so everybody...
Hi, my name is Mariana Neischler and I'm with the U.S. State Department, but this is just a personal interest here. So a little segue from what you just said. I think it's great to engage men. Obviously, that's a big step. But what I'm struggling with as a Northern Virginia mom is how to relate to stay-at-home moms. So I think we should engage with other types of women, groups of women, because all the choices we have to make on a daily basis, I feel relatively okay with the work requirements and all that, but the pressures that come from school are just killing me. And the expectations from the super moms who can volunteer for everything, that's where I really reach a breaking point. And I feel that all these recent books are very much appealing to those of us who work and who are successful in the, you know, normal way, or in the way we are used to think of it. But there's some women who might feel marginalized without you meaning to do that, but they don't seem to be part of the conversation. So just wondering what
So let me give you a couple of very, very specific responses, because I thought about this a lot. I think you're entirely right. I was in Hong Kong a couple years ago talking about this, and I was the Hong Kong Women's Financial Association. And it became clear that half of the room was working moms and half of the room was stay-at-home moms. But the Hong Kong Women's Financial Association invited the stay-at-home moms to all of their events because the working moms were aware that they could work in large part because the stay-at-home moms were taking care of the bake sales and the PT. I thought that was a brilliant model. Invite them in. I think the other piece of this is making these tough choices. You don't have to go to every PTA meeting as a working mom. And somebody, one of my neighbors once yelled at me, she's like, you know, don't take that position at the school fair because there's another woman who actually wants it. You don't want it. So let her take it. And I mean that seriously. You know, I've got enough organizing in my professional life. So don't do things out of a sense of guilt. And I think engage these conversations. And I think just going back to what we said earlier, easier said than done, don't fall into the nastiness. You know, I think we have to validate women's decisions to stay home. If they can afford to do it and that's their choice, validate it. And try and avoid the sort of nastiness that goes on and invite them into the conversation. And then my last thing is organize to get the schools to get the calendars out earlier. You know, there's some simple things that I think
working parents' lives would be easier if the schools could just get some information out more than the night before.
Do you want to say
something? I love what Deborah just said. You know, you need to do what's right for you. Your goal is not to please those other mothers or show to those other mothers what you're doing, but to respect them. I mean, I think what this ought to be about is respect for other people's choices. But I think it's so important that you try to think what is best for you. And if you don't want to do the PTA, don't offer to do it. Do what's core to you. I think the other thing that is very concerning is you told the story about the playground, but there's also a lot of stuff out there, which I'm sure you've seen, this preachy good mother blogs. And, you know, that bothers me too, because everybody's got to figure out what works for them and their family.
There's another dimension of this. I just want to bring it up and ask you to talk about it a second, and then we'll go to another question back there. But, and you brought this up, we were at a book party a couple nights ago. It's this issue of the young women that you are seeing going through Barnard who have all of these expectations and seem crushed by those burdens of trying to do everything. So they're exhausted by the time they're 19. I just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're really at a moment now, and hopefully the pendulum's going to swing again, but the uber parenting has gotten totally out of control. And I see it at the receiving end, because I get the 18-year-olds. And these are kids, perhaps because they have been uber-parented. You know, they have gone to so many dance performances, and they've been in every soccer league, and the traveling swimming team, and the pottery club, and they've started NGOs. These kids are exhausted. And, you know, I am a political scientist by training, so it's a collective action problem. But somehow we all have to kind of chill out in terms of the expectations we're pushing on these kids. Because, I mean, it's easy to joke about it, but it's really quite damaging. I'm seeing kids, and this is not Barnard specific. It cuts across Northern Virginia, Westchester, you know, Los Angeles. These kids are exhausted and in many ways damaged by the time they get to college, which, of course, is the point when they actually are supposed to work hard and discover themselves intellectually, but they've just been kind of scarred going through high school.
It's also, you know, I'll just say one thing before we go back. You know, there's a little problem in our society with being over-programmed. It's you get over-programmed in your life, but you also, you know, I mean, the average American spends 17 hours a day with some form of electrical stimulus in their life, right? An iPod, a radio, a computer, a television set on somewhere in their life. That means effectively every waking minute there's something going on. If you don't have an hour to yourself, if you don't have quiet time, what you also lose is creativity.
Absolutely.
You also lose the ability to recharge. You become less good. Doing everything makes you less good. And so that's just another thing that eats away at this. Right in the back, and then we'll move on. We're going to go here with this conversation for another 15 minutes, so just so everybody knows.
My name is Lisa Cook. Hi, Deb.
Oh, my gosh.
And the reason I'm even asking this question is because I won't be able to stay, and I apologize in advance. We were colleagues at Harvard. I was at the Kennedy School when she was at the business school. And that leads to my question. I'm a professor at Michigan State University and was at the Council of Economic Advisors last year. This is my question. Have you been reading, I'm sure you have, about the Harvard Business School equity experiment? So, given that, and I was at Google recently talking to them about their equity experiments. Women apparently don't volunteer for raises at Google like men do, and they have to prod them to get them to ask for raises. So in your roles, let's say as a board member of Goldman Sachs, how do you interpret this this experiment, and what do you think about the experiment, first of all, and its results, and what are the implications for the rest of society?
Well, let me just back up a little bit. I think this article that came out about HBS, I think it was very bold, and I think once the sort of kerfuffle dies down, I think this will have been a very important thing to do, because HBS, to some extent, is sort of the microcosm of power centers. I mean, it captures something in an extreme form that does cut across the broader society.
So once again, it just puts some more information into the conversation. I think what HBS is
trying...
You mean
any school that could produce George W. Bush and Mitt Romney?
Yeah, yeah. I'm not even going to go there.
Okay.
But I, you know, it's clearly this is cuts home, cuts close to home. I know all the players involved there. But I give them huge kudos. You know, you have a situation where a female president of Harvard kind of let it be made known to a native Indian-born male dean of Harvard Business School that things had to change. And he empowered the first openly lesbian woman on the faculty and a young Korean mom of two to address the problem. So this is kind of the outside faction, you know, trying to change a heavily white male heterosexual organization. So I give them great kudos for even trying. And I give HBS great kudos for allowing Jodi Decanter to come in and interview whoever she wanted with no constraints and put it all out there in 3 pages in the New York Times. Whether the experiment will work, I don't know. It's a tough place to change. But some of the things that the article sort of poked fun at, I actually think are quite serious. The most important one being teaching women how to raise their hands. I mean, it sounds absurd, you know, to read it in black and white, but having been there for nearly 20 years, it's a place kind of like corporate America where you get judged by putting your hand up. And, you know, I watched it. The women would put their hands up and then take them down, and then put it up and then take it down if a guy said something close, whereas the guys just kept their hands up for 90 minutes straight. And the guys did better in class. So actually teaching the women how to put their hands up is not silly. And teaching some, and I was a junior faculty member there. I had been a very highly ranked professor before I came to HBS. I got clobbered my first year in the classroom, clobbered, to the point where, you know, I wanted to leave because it was such a demoralizing experience. And I wouldn't have made it if a couple of male mentors hadn't pulled me aside and said, okay, this is what you're doing wrong. So I think they're legitimately trying to tackle the problem. I don't know if it will work, but, you know, I wish them all the luck in the world. It's important.
Can I just say one thing there? First of all, if you haven't read this article, I suggest you do, because I had two reactions to it. One, I was shocked at what really goes on there, if that is...
It's true.
It's
all
true.
Yeah.
You have to read it. I was telling you, I was shocked. I was shaking for days. It was so extreme in so many ways. But second, I thought it was remarkable what they're doing. I really did. And I was trying to think through how do we replicate that, because it was very creative and very serious. Read this article.
Okay. I'm going to go next to this woman here who's waiting a second. Then I'm going to get a guy. Right over here. Okay. And then we'll come back here in a second. But before we go, in what Deb said, there was an opportunity here, when you talk about teaching the women to raise their hands, to make a 30-second pitch on why women's only education is still relevant today, and I'm not going to ask the president of Barnard to do it.
That's correct. I'm going to ask that.
Okay. Well, you go ahead.
I'm a great advocate for women's education, because I think it's even today with the Ivy League open to women, it's a great opportunity to build your skills and for camaraderie and for a network for life. It is a powerful way to learn in a very supportive environment. And I actually, you know, a lot of people say, oh, it doesn't translate when you leave. I have helped and worked with many Wellesley women if they've gone on. I think it's fantastic. The network I've had and the support I have from the women in my class and in many other activities in which I participate is priceless.
And you could even see a Wellesley woman someday becoming president of the United States.
I'm counting on it. I'm counting on it. But I think that many women don't, you know, they're not comfortable doing that. I respect that. But for those who see the potential opportunities, I think it's fantastic. And Barnard's the perfect place because Columbia's right there.
That's right. We're the women's college with boys.
Yeah. Which is,
but just to add, and this, you know, I've seen, because I've been at co-ed institutions actually most of my career, I think what women's colleges offer is a form of protection for 4 critical years, so you literally learn to put your hand up.
Because what I've seen elsewhere is the smart girl is in the math class, and all of a sudden she's worried about putting her hand up because she's worried if she gets it wrong that the boy next to her, the girl next to her, won't think as highly of her. So she puts her hand down. Whereas if you have 4 years where you don't have to worry about sort of your social life in the classroom, it gives you that confidence that when you do go out into the real world, you put your hands up.
Say, when you're a boy and you're raised that, if you get the answer wrong, there's always a career for you in Washington.
Well, I am Liliana Rodriguez. I'm from Buenos Aires, Argentina, national defense expert, and I obtained my degree here in the National Defense University. But I have a question. Why is that in this country, generally, with the exception of Hillary Clinton, first ladies do not have a most important role within politics? For example.
You mean like becoming president of Argentina?
No, I don't. I mean, they don't have an important role within the White House with a legitimate work asking, requesting, or proposing to the Congress laws that can consider women not only within the U.S. territory but outside.
Okay. Julia's sitting here going, I'm writing a biography of Lady Bird Johnson. Yeah. Wait for that. Yeah. It shows the beginning, but go on.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't have a good answer to it. And I think, unfortunately, we do tend to push our first ladies to be sort of take the mother role much more than a policy role. And it's probably not the best model.
Well, it's the societal and political pressures. Hillary had a different role as first lady. And there was such attack on her that she could not even do what Eleanor Roosevelt had done many, many years earlier. So the politically safe route is to have a first lady that sticks within narrow confines. I find it very sad and a part of this broader societal problem that we have, people's attitudes toward women.
And there is Jodi Kantor, who wrote the New York Times article, also wrote a biography of the Obamas, where she touches on sort of how Michelle had to change her persona as she moved into that role.
Tara, this gentleman here. I'm gonna show a little equity here. Yeah. You're on thin. You haven't said a word. You're on thin ice.
Yeah, that's right. Poor guy hasn't even started.
Okay, my name is Mark Botsford of Botsford Global. And I just wanted to first make a couple of observations on what you all
very
had
brief
already
ones.
Stopped.
We only have 5 minutes.
Okay, one is, the women's struggle here in the United States. My defining moment was when I had my first job in New York on Wall Street. I'm not going to name the bank, where all the VPs, the female VPs were padding, that slot, the VP slot, so that men couldn't rise up above them. And I was shocked by how they felt that that's what they had to do. And then the next defining moment was when I moved down to South America for 22 years, just got back, and I found that the women in South America were more willing to not fight on men's terms, where in the United States I felt that they were fighting on male's terms.
You're about to be attacked by a South American woman behind you, so.
No, I'm not, because I think she'd agree
defense
with me.
Expert too. Defense expert, too.
The reason why women, my wife is from South America, she's from Argentina as well, but what I found in South America is that the women, they felt they were better naturally, and so there wasn't a competition.
It's a different angle.
There wasn't a competition like there is here, and so I just wanted to know if you could address that. And about your comment, David, about managed equity in Scandinavian countries, I was hoping you would elaborate a little bit more on that, and whether or not you think that's applicable here in the United States.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, on the South American, I don't know enough to comment there, but I will sort of not answer your question by saying, one of the things I've noticed, Barnard has a global symposium where we go to a different part of the world every year, and I think we started out, looking at the fate of women, the status of women, I think we started out with sort of a traditional American-centric view that, we are going to be better at feminism than these other countries to which we will bring our learning, and, totally wrong. And I think in many ways, certainly when we went to the Middle East, I felt that the women there were dealing with, you know, struggles far greater than ours. But women in India, despite, you know, massive issues with rape and sexual violence, in terms of the workplace, there's I think, more women running Indian banks, far more, definitely, than there are in the United States. In China, the women have much greater networks of state-sponsored childcare, and, you know, different working arrangements. So I think, and then we were in Brazil last year, Julia helped, you know, women are running large chunks of the government there. So I think, and I don't know why, but I think Americans in many regards are actually behind many of our peer nations with regards to just the numbers of women in positions of power and these broader social norms that still surround us. I can't tell you why, but it's a good question.
But there's organized political forces in the United States that believe it is appropriate to argue for a different role for women, and believe it's appropriate to constrain the role of women with society, and they actually attribute it to something beyond social norms, but, you know, the kind of theological premises that you can't easily argue with. The brief point about Scandinavia is whether it's women on boards being mandated positions on boards, or women being mandated positions in the government, or percentage of positions in the government, or women being or coming up with better maternity policies and paternity policies, they have systematically seen the need and the benefits of having the government come in and try to address what society and markets left on their own wouldn't address for a couple of thousands of years. And it's produced more equitable leadership. It's produced greater performance in their societies, and it's produced societies that consistently score significantly higher than the United States on metrics that we don't even look at, like happiness, like satisfaction with people's lives. We're always competing to be number one, but we never ask what we want to be number one at. It's not so great to be the biggest and the most powerful if you're not the happiest or most satisfied with your lives. There are other societies using different kind of metrics, and it benefits them. We have time for one more question. Okay, you seem urgent.
He's putting her hand up.
Thank you. My name is Eleanor Lacaine, and I was one of the first women graduates of Yale. We were excited at the time about the breakthroughs for women and celebrated, you know, first woman astronaut, first woman on the Supreme Court. We said, here we go, we're on our way to women's equality. Now we're looking back 30 years later going, we got certain distance, yeah, but we noticed this thing about, we call it the 20% barrier, and it is in every field. We just organized the Yale Women in a network for the first time ever called Yale Women, and we were thinking, what is the one thing we all want to work on together? And we decided that the most important thing was this kind of 50-50, like addressing this barrier that women are still bumping up against. So you had mentioned earlier about the importance of you and Sheryl Sandberg connecting with the women's organizations to deal with this issue, to find out what is the real blockage and how do we get through it. So I'm the chair of the Yale Women in D.C., and I'm giving you my card, and I would love to strategize with you and connect and cooperate and collaborate to break that final barrier for women.
You got it.
Great.
Thanks.
Great.
Thank you.
Everybody is going to have an opportunity to give Deborah their card or have her sign the book in a minute, because she's graciously consented to spend another 20 minutes here signing books and talking to you here. But I do want to give you guys each a kind of a chance to perhaps respond to that and perhaps to have a last word. So let me go to Sue first.
Well, I just actually would like to say what a fantastic contribution. For those of you who have not had a chance to read it, not only is it a great contribution to the discussion, one that we've only begun, contrary to the New York Times, but it's also a great and fun read.
Thank you.
So thank you. You've given me a lot to think about, and I think actually a lot of young women, because you know what young women want is the issues out on the table. So I would like to join you in working with you as we try to go forward to solve what I think are our big issues, but the most important.
Thank you. So I'll just wrap up by really expressing my gratitude to David, to you, for everyone for being here today. And I think, you know, without running the risk of sounding too
preacherly here. You know, I think everyone in this room has had a measure of success. And I think both women and men do have an obligation, particularly if they have been successful, to tell the stories of their lives to younger people without always burnishing them, so it to make them look too easy or too seamless. I think one of the best things we can do for the generation coming along is in no way to diminish their ambition, but tell them, hold on to that ambition, but be prepared for the bumps in the road. Here are my bumps. Here are the tough decisions I made. How can I help you get through yours? And I think, you know, just by having those conversations without trying to look like we're Wonder Women or Supermen, we actually can really help push the dynamic along. And there may be something very Scandinavian about that as well, that, you know, thinking about different metrics and not defining everything as a race for GDP growth and, you know, being wealthy, the president, what have you, I think we can start to reframe the conversation. So thank you.
I want to thank all of you for coming. I want to thank Tara Chandra, who makes everything possible here for us at Carnegie, for helping to pull all of this together. And I want to thank Susan and Deborah for such a terrific discussion. Please come and continue the conversation here. Thanks very much for joining us.